From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bill Clinton and his running mate Al Gore are both members of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, a group whose mission has been to move the party toward the center. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the DLC and the direction of the Democratic Party with Jacob Weisberg, deputy editor of The New Republic, and feminist journalist Barbara Ehrenreich. Later, we'll meet Warrington and Reginald Hudlin, the filmmaking team behind the low-budget hit House Party and the big-budget hit Boomerang, starring Eddie Murphy. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Prelude to a Kiss, starring Alec Baldwin and Meg Ryan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe ended its two-day summit today. The meeting was dominated by the crisis in Yugoslavia. The BBC's Sally Eacroyd reports from Helsinki.
The crisis in Yugoslavia dominated talk at the two-day summit. The leaders ended their meeting with a statement condemning the violence there and putting most of the blame squarely on the Serb authorities and the Serbian-dominated army. The final declaration adopted by the leaders is designed to prevent re-emergent nationalism fanning similar conflicts elsewhere. With its new powers, the group will concentrate on preventive measures, setting up an early warning system to identify trouble spots before the violence starts. A new High Commissioner for Minorities will be empowered to investigate complaints and recommend solutions. The CSCE will sponsor peacekeeping operations, sending observers, monitors, and peacekeeping forces to areas that agree to accept them.
The BBC's Sally Eacroyd. Two rival Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip have reportedly agreed to stop fighting among themselves after a week of bloody clashes. The two groups are the Palestine Liberation Organization's Fatah group and the Islamic fundamentalist Hamas movement. They're at odds over Palestinian participation in the Middle East peace talks. A boy was killed and more than 150 people have been injured in fighting between supporters of the two groups in the Israeli-occupied territories. The clashes reportedly continued even as the truce was being negotiated. The Alaska Court of Appeals has overturned a misdemeanor conviction against former Exxon Valdez Captain Joseph Hazelwood in connection with the spill of 11 million gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound. The justices ruled unanimously that Hazelwood should have been granted immunity from prosecution. Julie Gibson of Alaska Public Radio has more.
The three-judge panel overturned Hazelwood's conviction on the grounds that the state used as evidence Hazelwood's initial report of the spill. Federal law forbids the use of such a report by the prosecution. Hazelwood was out to sea today and unavailable for comment, but his attorney, Michael Chalos, says he believes the tanker captain has been completely vindicated.
You're talking about a very accomplished mariner. It's just unfortunate that, and we've said this many, many times in the past, that he's been used as a scapegoat for a faulty system.
Hazelwood has maintained that he gave proper orders that would have steered the tanker clear of Bligh Reef. Anchorage District Attorney Edward McNally says the state will appeal today's ruling to the state Supreme Court. More than 100 civil suits against Hazelwood and Exxon are still pending. For National Public Radio, I'm Julie Gibson in Anchorage.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 6 points to close at 3,330.56. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. A federal judge in Miami has sentenced former Panamanian ruler Manuel Noriega to 40 years in prison. Noriega was convicted on 8 counts of drug trafficking and racketeering. Prosecutors asked Judge William Hoover to sentence Noriega to as much as 120 years in jail for allowing Colombia's Medellin cartel to smuggle cocaine through Panama to the United States. In a nearly 3-hour statement before the sentencing, Noriega charged that he was a victim of politics by the Reagan and Bush administrations. Brazilian President Fernando Collor says his company has dramatically improved its foreign debt structure. He says this is a better deal than previous ones administered by other Latin American countries. From Rio de Janeiro, NPR's David Wilner reports.
In a speech to the nation last night, President Kohler called the debt deal good news. He said no other country has ever made such an innovative agreement and guaranteed that Brazil is capable of fulfilling its terms. The agreement has yet to be approved by Brazil's Congress, as well as the individual creditor banks. It could reduce Brazil's $44 billion debt with foreign private banks by about 35%. That commercial debt amounts to only about a third of the country's overall foreign debt, which is the largest in the developing world. President Kohler said the agreement will bring new investment and jobs to Brazil, which has largely neglected its commercial debt in recent years. Kohler pointed to the deal as evidence that allegations of corruption against him have not paralyzed his government. I'm David Wellner in Rio de Janeiro.
The South African government said today that it will take positive steps to end the current impasse over power-sharing talks. The African National Congress withdrew from the talks last month, protesting that the government was involved in the massacre of 43 people in the black township of Boipatong. A spokesman for the white minority government said today that the government would not be pressured by protests or strikes. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bill Clinton has chosen Al Gore as his vice presidential running mate. Clinton and Gore have a lot in common. They're both in their 40s, they're both from the South, and they're both members of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council. Since 1985, the DLC has been moving the Democratic Party toward the center. A little later, we'll hear from feminist writer Barbara Ehrenreich, who thinks the new ticket and the Democratic Party's direction is leaving many Americans out in the cold. But first we'll hear from New Republic Deputy Editor Jacob Weisberg, who's been following the growth of the Democratic Leadership Council. I asked him if he thinks the Clinton-Gore ticket represents the growing influence of the DLC.
I think it does, and I think it represents a real change in the Democratic Party. These are two men, both from a faction of the party that is more moderate, more conservative on foreign policy, more reformist on a lot of domestic policy areas than any ticket the Democratic Party has presented before.
Let's go back in history a little bit to 1985, not very far back in history, when the DLC was founded. Who were the founding members, and what was the very initial idea?
Well, Dick Gephardt was one of the founding members. Bill Clinton was another. And the idea really was in reaction to the loss in 1984 by Walter Mondale of rethinking what the Democratic Party stood for, trying to pull it away from this perception that it was dominated by liberal interest groups, give it a more moderate cast, give it a greater cast of family values. Some of the people who were involved in the founding of the DLC thought the Democratic Party was too extreme on the issue of abortion. They thought the only way to appeal to moderate voters was to somehow split the difference between a pro-life and a pro-choice stance. Those people really have been rebuffed. I think the DLC has emerged with the rest of the Democratic Party as unequivocally pro-choice and agrees that that's a winning political position. But the larger sense of moderation has carried through and is represented by this ticket.
What else do they stand for? They stand for what they describe as entrepreneurial government. What does that mean?
Well, that's a phrase I think David Osborne, who's a political writer, came up with, which means, in some cases, privatization of what have been government services. Ideas like vouchers in the public schools, school choice, selling public housing units to their residents. Now, it should be said that not all people in the DLC agree with all these ideas. Clinton, for example, supports a modified version of school choice. He doesn't support choice that would enable parents to use government money to put their children in private schools. The DLC simply is more prone to the more conservative reformist view than the party's traditional stand.
Would you describe the DLC as more hawkish than other Democrats? And the reason why I ask that is all of the Democrats who voted for George Bush's Gulf War resolution were in the DLC.
That's right. It certainly is more hawkish. That was one of the reasons it was created, to counter the perception that the party was dominated by the so-called McGovern wing, who were reflexively against intervention in any kind of foreign conflict and reflexively against the Pentagon budget. It should be added, though, that while all the Democratic senators who voted for the war were DLC members, there were also as many DLC members who were Democrats who voted against the war. The DLC has become a very large and populist faction, and a lot of people in Congress have joined it really as a way just to pick up another few initials after their name. And so in the last few years, the DLC's strength of conviction in some ways has become diluted.
Well, as more and more diverse people join it.
Absolutely. So it's, while you can still say it's more conservative, more hawkish, more willing to support foreign intervention than others in the Democratic Party, there are a lot of counterexamples to all of those points.
What kind of conflicts have there been over the years between the DLC and the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, which is the official governing body of the committee?
There have been some. The DNC has been jealous when it has seen the DLC as trying to replace it. And there have been a few instances in the last few years where the DLC has seemed to position itself as a rival DNC. Clinton said something last year, before he was the front runner for president, something to the effect that he would like to see the DLC become what people thought of when they think of the Democratic Party. And Ron Brown, the chairman of the DNC, objected strongly to that, and I think he responded that it was a good thing Clinton had promised he wasn't going to run for president in 1992. Since then, things have been patched over, and the DLC people aren't really that dissatisfied with the Democratic National Committee now, because under Ron Brown, the Democratic National Committee has really been very neutral. It's dedicated itself to fundraising and to the proposition of electing a Democratic president, almost whoever it is.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. My guest is Jacob Weisberg. He's the deputy editor of The New Republic. And we're talking about the influence of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, the influence of that group within the Democratic Party. The DLC describes itself as being against special interest group politics. Who are the special interest groups they have in mind when they say that?
Well, I think they're talking first and foremost about the unions. And there are a couple that they have in mind in particular. One is the National Education Association, the teachers' union. This is seen as a stalwart of the old Democratic Party, the party of Carter and Mondale and Dukakis, candidates who the National Education Association supported unequivocally and unreservedly. The Democratic Leadership Council has seen, in this instance in particular, the teachers' union as an obstacle to reforming schools. And so when they talk about the special interests, they're talking about groups like that. They're also talking about groups like the Rainbow Coalition and Jesse Jackson. Not to say that blacks are a special interest within the party, but that the civil rights lobby as constituted demands a set of programs and platforms from the Democratic Party, which are in the end self-defeating.
The Democratic Party has always been the party of unions, so it seems to me that the DLC could really alienate an important constituency for the party.
Well, that's been a real issue in the party, and I think the success of Bill Clinton so far is that he's been able to bridge this gap. He's been able to take what is more or less recognizable as a DLC line, which includes an element of union bashing, because, for instance, unions will be very opposed to any kind of privatization of government services that hurts, among others, public employee unions. But he's done that and at the same time gone to unions and appealed to them and won union support.
Clinton was the first chair of the DLC. Is the DLC still solidly behind him?
Oh, it is, absolutely. And just to pick up on what I was saying a minute ago, this is what Democrats see as so promising about the Clinton campaign, is that he bridges this gap. A lot of people saw the 1992 Democratic primary shaping up as a conflict within the Democratic Party between its traditional wing, represented by someone like Mario Cuomo, say, and its DLC wing, represented by someone like Clinton or Gore. And what Clinton has done, really, is transcended that division. The DLC people are for him, and most of the traditional Democrats, Cuomo hanging in the balance, are for him as well.
Well, aren't some of them for him because they don't have much of a choice?
I think that's right. Democrats are desperate now. They want a president. They want there to be a Democratic president in their lifetimes. And they see Clinton, whatever problems they have with him, as a reasonable compromise.
Right. So, I mean, I'm not quite sure if he's exactly bridging the gap or if people are rallying behind him because he's the only guy there is right now.
Well, I think you could say both things, but I would point to him bridging the gap in instances where he has not taken the most conservative DLC-type position. On school choice, for example, as we were talking about, the DLC supports voucher choice, or at least it's a policy wing, a group called the Progressive Policy Institute does. That's the same kind of choice program that President Bush supports. Clinton, however, has been more equivocal about it. He supports some kind of choice, but it's probably not the kind of choice that involves private schools, which allows the NEA to support him, although they're a little skeptical, and still allows people in the DLC and people who support school choice to think that he's going to go farther on that issue than any Democrat has to date.
One of the criticisms that Jesse Jackson has made of the DLC is that the council is trying to suburbanize the Democratic Party. Does he have a point there?
I'm not sure really what that means. It's certainly true that the voting base of the country has become increasingly suburban election after election. And it may be that a DLC line will appeal to more to suburban voters who are more likely to be white voters, less likely to appeal automatically to blacks and to union workers, white blue-collar workers in big cities. But so far, Clinton seems to be doing a pretty good job of keeping black support.
So do you see the DLC as appealing to suburbanites at the expense of having policies that would appeal to people living in the inner city?
No, I don't really, because what we're talking about are issues like welfare reform. Now, it may be that by saying that members of the urban underclass should be given jobs instead of welfare, Clinton will appeal more to suburban voters. But he may also appeal to urban black voters themselves. Jesse Jackson seems to assume that that kind of line is a challenge to black voters, but Clinton's had a lot of success with it.
And when Jackson has criticized the ticket of Clinton and Gore, he said they're both DLC, they're too much alike.
That's exactly his position. And what it represents, really, is the left wing of the Democratic Party being shut out of national politics.
Your magazine, The New Republic, was really behind Gore in 88 when he was making a bid for the Democratic nomination for president. Were you in on the writing of that editorial?
Actually, I was not at the magazine in 1988, although I was there previous to that. But it is true that the New Republic has been supportive of Gore. He's one of the few Democratic politicians we feel close to and agree with. Clinton is another one. This is a ticket that the New Republic editors on the whole are very happy with.
Why?
Well, because we have made some of these arguments in recent years about the Democratic Party losing its moorings, really straying from a reasonable liberal position on a lot of issues. Defense is one of them. We supported the war in Iraq. Most of the Democrats didn't. Al Gore was one of the only Democrats in the Senate who voted for the war. Bill Clinton, who didn't have to vote on the war, says he was for it too. That makes them exceptional among Democrats, and it makes them more congenial to most of the editors of my magazine.
Mm-hmm. What are you going to be watching for at the convention in terms of the kind of dynamics of power within the Democratic Party?
Well, I think the real question for the convention is whether the ideological quarrel that has characterized Democratic Party politics since 1972 still exists. In past conventions, as dull as they've been, there's been a sort of side game of watching who the keynote speaker is, who got this privilege, who got that perk, who's introducing who, and what it means in terms of the left, right, and center of the party. And I think the question for New York is whether that division still exists and whether it's going to manifest itself, or whether Democrats are going to so unite behind this ticket that it's not even going to be visible.
Do you think even if it's not visible that it still exists, it's just not being shown to the public?
I think it still exists, but I think this ticket has the chance to transcend that fight. If Clinton and Gore run and they lose badly, people will say, the traditionalists in the party will say, see what happens, we strayed from our traditional base and we lost, and it's time to go back to the core values we represent. If, on the other hand, this ticket is successful, I think the traditional wing of the party will be really left without anywhere to go, and I think you'll see them scramble to join the Clinton administration.
Jacob Weisberg is the deputy editor of The New Republic. Coming up, feminist journalist Barbara Ehrenreich tells us why she thinks the DLC and Bill Clinton are leading the party in the wrong direction. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. Not everyone agrees with Jacob Weisberg's observation that Bill Clinton is bridging the gap between the different factions within the Democratic Party. Jesse Jackson, for instance, has criticized the ticket for having two members of the DLC, which he's described as Democrats for the leisure class. Barbara Ehrenreich is a feminist journalist who thinks the party is shutting out many Americans. She's an essayist for Time magazine and will be writing about the convention for New York Newsday. As a longtime leftist and registered Democrat, she thinks the DLC has been leading the party in the wrong direction, and she's not very happy with the ticket.
Well, I thought that there was going to be a little more balance. I really did. I thought that that Clinton would pick someone somewhat more liberal than himself. That was my expectation, but in fact, they're just twins. It's hard to tell any difference at all, except, you know, that Clinton didn't inhale, but Gore admits he did. You know, it's at that level that we can discern differences here.
Gore and Clinton are both members of the Democratic Leadership Council. What do you think of the DLC's influence on the party?
Well, this is their moment. I mean, this is their strategy they've been talking about. They wanted a relatively conservative candidate. Clinton is the one. Unfortunately for them, the whole strategy was crafted before Perot. You know, before anybody could have imagined that people could bolt from the Democratic Party if they wanted to. Not that Perot is maybe going to be the most attractive place for people to bolt to, but suddenly it's wide open. Nobody feels that old loyalty. It's not just either or, the lesser of two evils. So it's a more wide open situation. There's much more discontent than they were surely thinking of when they came up with this sort of Clinton-esque strategy. It was the Gulf War had ended. There was this frenzy of appreciation for George Bush, et cetera. Then came the recession. Everything is different. People are much more discontented and angry, as we all know.
So you think that the move toward the center isn't necessarily the best strategy now for the Democratic Party?
Well, no. I mean, here was their chance. Here was their great moment, especially considering the recession, which is always going to be good for the Democrats, in a sense, to say, the rich guys have been running things long enough. We really are different. I think Jerry Brown tried this in a way. Certainly Jesse Jackson tried this in 1988 and, began to stir up a new mood, a more radical, challenging mood, which, unfortunately, I think the DLC is not interested in stirring up.
Jesse Jackson described the DLC as representing the suburbanization of the party. I wonder if you think that that the DLC or that the Clinton-Gore ticket represent the suburbanization of the party.
Well, that's what they're thinking, because that's, I think, the inside theory now. Forget the cities. Anybody who votes is living in the suburbs. Forget low-income people, as if there were no low-income people in the suburbs, and so on. That's definitely the thinking. I mean, that's the sort of intellectual currency today. It was a cover story in Atlantic Monthly. I guess it's this month. William Schneider has a column on it as we speak about the suburbs. That's the new frontier. Forget everybody else. And, of course, the stereotype of the suburbs, I think, is really very wrong. These are not the suburbs anymore. I'm living in the suburbs here. These are not the suburbs of 1955. Suburbs of 1992 have, a lot of these three-bedroom homes are housing three generations because nobody can afford to move out when they grow up. A lot of these homes are housing, though they may be very well kept up, may be housing people on welfare, people who are on food stamps because they've lost jobs. So I think there's sort of a stereotype of the suburbs that isn't going to work either.
Who do you see as being disenfranchised from the Democratic ticket now?
Well, most obviously what's been going on is thumbing of noses to the so-called special interests, and I shudder every time Bill Clinton uses that phrase because he doesn't mean the real special interests, the bankers and the oil companies and so on. He means women, minorities, labor, etc., just as the Republicans would use the term. And most clearly he's snubbing his nose at African Americans. I think that's, that was the Sister Souljah lecture, distancing himself from Jesse Jackson, then the choice of Gore, another person who did not make a big hit with African Americans when he was in New York City campaigning in 1988. In fact, he was He was pretty, he ended up turning off just about everybody with his, shall I say, pandering to Ed Koch. So that's, I think that's the big thing. Distance yourself from the blacks. That seems to be the theme here. It's almost like a rite of passage, a way that you prove your manhood if you're a politician these days. Denounce Sister Soldier. Denounce Ice-T. That's kind of discouraging when you think, to use the phrase, the cliche they always use, what we need is a little healing here.
So you don't think that Bill Clinton is bridging the gap between the different factions within the Democratic Party?
Well, I don't know what the different factions all might be, for sure. He's certainly got the support of a lot of pro-choice women. He's, come out looking pretty good on that. Labor, his record is very bad on, and he has not done anything to heal that. I mean, he had in New York City and the primaries, he had the Teamsters going to Jerry Brown. He had the hospital workers going to Jerry Brown, not so much because they, were truly positively attracted to Brown, but because they were so horrified by Clinton's record. And he hasn't tried to bridge that. And as I said, he's doing everything possible to show that he's as far as he can be from listening to African-American concerns.
As a Democrat yourself, do you feel any closer to or distant from the Democratic Party now than you have in the past few years and in the past few presidential elections?
Yes, I think I feel more distanced. I think, like a lot of people, I'm thinking that the third party sort of initiative this year shouldn't have been Ross Perot, though nothing could have stopped him, I guess. But there should have been something from the left. There should have been a more liberal alternative to the Democratic Party, because the Democrats now, are very, very centrist. The Republicans are very, very far right. So where's a real alternative? Where is something that, a perspective that doesn't have to be a replay of the New Deal, doesn't have to be a replay of the 1960s, but a perspective that really starts from the people who are suffering most now, the unemployed, the underpaid, the laid off, the people who I'm afraid get lumped into a special interest in Bill Clinton's view of the universe.
Barbara Ehrenreich is an essayist for Time magazine. She'll be covering the media coverage of the convention for New York Newsday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After Warrington and Reginald Hudlin produced and directed the low-budget hit House Party, they got a call from Eddie Murphy, who wanted the Hudlin brothers to make his next film. Coming up, we talk with the Hudlins about making the new movie Boomerang, starring Eddie Murphy. Also, the Broadway hit Prelude to a Kiss is now a movie, starring Alec Baldwin, Meg Ryan, Kathy Bates, and Patty Duke. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Manuel Noriega was sentenced to 40 years in prison today on his 8 drug convictions. The former Panamanian dictator read a lengthy statement during his sentencing hearing this afternoon. Reporter Melissa Mancini was in the courtroom and describes Noriega's statement.
He said, quote, "My indictment was orchestrated by those who feared me, men who sought to discredit me." He said that Panama is not a colony of the United States. It never was, nor will it ever be, and it will never be a star on the glorious flag of the United States. He had many references to George Bush, accused him of genocide during the 1989 invasion of Panama. He said that George Bush killed more than 5,000 inhabitants of Panama, that he experimented with war technology in a war against Panama. He destroyed thousands of homes and did not make good on his promises of economic assistance to help the Panamanians rebuild their damaged homes because of Operation Just Cause.
Melissa Mancini reporting from Miami. A federal jury awarded 23,000 plaintiffs more than $4 billion in damages in their case against ex-financier Charles Keating and 3 co-defendants. $2.1 billion will come from Keating himself, but the former owner of Lincoln Savings and Loan says he's now indigent. The damage awards come after 8 days of deliberations in Tucson, Arizona. Soon-to-be Democratic presidential nominee Bill Clinton and his running mate Albert Gore held their first joint press conference this morning in Little Rock. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The two young, moderate Southerners described themselves as a real partnership. If elected, Clinton said, he would send Gore, a 2-term United States senator from Tennessee, up to Capitol Hill to work with the United States Congress to break the logjam. And Clinton offered another response to the Republicans' charges that Democrats lack support for family values.
If you're in public life and you're a public servant, when you talk about family values, it ought to be family values plus what you're going to do to help people raise their families and keep them strong. And their family values minus. When they talk about family values, it's a way of letting themselves off the hook for having no vision, no program, and no plan.
Clinton and Gore plan to campaign together in Tennessee before they travel to the Democratic Party convention in New York. They'll both appear before the annual convention of the NAACP tomorrow in Nashville. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
Olympia and York reported a $1.75 billion loss for its fiscal 1992 year today. That's more than 5 times its loss from last year. The heavy debt load of O&Y and its lack of ability to finance it led it to file bankruptcy earlier this year. Stock prices closed up on Wall Street today. The Dow advanced 6 points to finish at 3330.56. Trading was active. This is NPR. President Bush today denounced a new anti-Bill Clinton campaign ad and called on the producer of the spot to withdraw it. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The ad is independently produced by Floyd Brown, the political operative who created the Willie Horton ad in 1988. The new ad attacks Clinton's character and calls on viewers to call a 1-800 phone number to hear recordings of staged conversations between Clinton and Jennifer Flowers, the Arkansas woman who claims to have had an affair with Clinton. In an interview with PBS's McNeil Lair NewsHour, President Bush told Brown to pull the ads off the air.
"We're not in that business. That man knows that he ought to stop it. We know he shouldn't be using that name, but committee, there's nothing we can do about it legally. But I hope what I'm telling you now resonates all across this country. I disapprove of it. We, our lawyers, have told him to stop it, and I hope he does."
Thus far, Brown says he has no plans to withdraw the ad. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The South African government says it will act to restart stalled talks with the African National Congress, but Pretoria says it won't be pressured into the effort by protests and a general strike planned for next month by anti-apartheid activists. The white-led government previously said the impasse could be solved only if the ANC stopped its confrontation politics and came back to the negotiating table. The ANC pulled out of talks last month, charging the government encourages township violence like the Boipatong massacre, in which 40 people died. The United Nations says the world's population now stands at 5.5 billion people. The world's annual growth rate remains at 1.7%, despite birth control efforts and the impact of AIDS. Tomorrow is the UN's World Population Day. The event focuses on global programs to balance population growth with economic resources and the environment. The UN says the world's population will hit 6.2 billion by the end of this decade. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Eddie Murphy's new hit comedy, Boomerang, was directed by Reginald Hudlin and produced by his brother Warrington Hudlin. The Hudlins also made the 1990 hit House Party. House Party was a low-budget film featuring young actors and rappers. But for Boomerang, the Hudlins had a budget of over $40 million and a big star. In fact, Murphy not only starred in the film, he conceived the idea and hired the Hudlins. He chose them because he liked House Party so much. I asked the Hudlins what it was like to go from a small-budget film to a big-budget vehicle for Eddie Murphy. Reginald answered first.
Well, the great thing is the reason why Eddie wanted to work with me because he really appreciated my sense of humor and my style of working. So when we worked on the script and were on the stage working, we were in agreement. We laugh at the same stuff. So I said, oh, this is funny. He goes, yeah, that is funny. Or that's not funny. Goes, yeah, that's not funny. So there wasn't a lot of conflict in that way. Because Eddie's directed himself and decided he really does not want to direct, he was looking for someone who was strong and in control. At the same time, I'm a person who likes to collaborate with the entire cast. So I don't mind listening to a great suggestion, whether it comes from the star or a gaffer. So it was a very good working experience.
There was no downside to having a really big budget and a really big star?
No, and the having, you know, produced a movie with only $2.5 million, you're constantly trying to, you know, turn a 99 cent into a dollar. You're always limited by your lack of financial resources. And what was refreshing about the Boomerang experience, that if you had a shot and Reggie says, oh, I want a helicopter in the shot or a crane, we could push the button and get those tools. A lot of what people come to associate as Hollywood production value are things that are made possible through the dollar. And by having a full-blown budget, Reggie, as a creative person, could have all the tools he needed.
Mm-hmm.
Although, fundamentally, funny is funny, and it's not really a function of budget.
Have you both sensed a change in Hollywood's attitude toward films that are directed by African-Americans or that have a predominantly African-American cast? I mean, you're part of this kind of new success story, and you know, it really does seem that Hollywood has kind of gotten the message that films directed by African-Americans or starring African-Americans can make profits.
We have to be vigilant that Hollywood does not regard the emerging black filmmaker as a source of cheap labor. Entertainment Weekly did an article this year analyzing the profits of the films in 1991. And at the top of the list was Boys in the Hood, a movie made for $6 million but ended up grossing $56 million at the box office. So in terms of ratio between money spent and money returned to box office, it was the most profitable. But that can be a trap because it can say to these filmmakers that only give them the kind of entry-level budgets. And we're in danger of becoming second-class participants in Hollywood. And since there's no ceiling on the box office of what we can make, there certainly should be no ceiling on the budgets we get. It's also complicated and compounded when you realize that certain types of stories, by definition, require bigger budgets. When you go into period films or science fiction films, those films have a higher price tag. And only contemporary drama can be done on low budget.
I was reading that in House Party, there's a cameo by George Clinton in House Party. He's kind of like the father of funk. And I was reading that some of the white executives who screened the movie didn't know who Clinton was, and so they were suggesting that you edit him out. Does that kind of thing happen a lot?
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of insensitivity and a lack of cultural awareness. And, you know, it's not even a racial thing. You just go, man, don't you watch MTV even? I mean, let alone BET. You know, there's
right,
a...
Right.
There's just a lack of awareness of what's happening in popular culture. I mean, when you look at groups like Crisscross and NWA being top of the pop charts, it says that black culture is has a product across the country. It's not broken down by racial lines. But there's a conventional wisdom that essentially boils down to prejudice, that if you have a film with black actors in it, only black people want to see it.
So is there another example of how a lack of cultural awareness at the top nearly hurt one of your films?
I mean that frustration, I mean, goes all the way down the line. It's just not simply studio executives. I mean, one of the things that's frustrating to us in some of the reviews of Boomerang is that people go, you know, hey, what kind of world is this that, you have this black company and then there are no white people in it, which is stunning to us.
Since we know we can... point out many such companies where people are very well dressed, make a lot of money, and involved in successful black entrepreneurship.
My guests are Reginald and Warrington Hudlin, the director and producer of the new Eddie Murphy comedy, Boomerang. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Reginald and Warrington Hudlin, who made the 1990 hit House Party and the new movie Boomerang. I'm interested in your personal stories. Warrington, you went to Yale, and I know that you started making documentaries when you were there.
Right.
What led you toward documentaries?
At the time, I was very impressed and influenced by the films of Fred Wiseman, and particularly his cinema verite technique. I found very engaging, very challenging. So I was interested in following that tradition.
Mm-hmm. One of the documentaries that you made was called Black at Yale. Was it a personal documentary, like an autobiographical documentary?
No, it's really more broadly philosophical. I was concerned about what it meant to be a black student at that university. And I initially started off by interviewing my classmates, giving their various perspectives on being black at Yale. But in the course of these interviews, I stumbled onto a young man who was probably the least representative, although I think in telling his story, I really made the most important commentary of being black at Yale. He was a young man who was from Philadelphia, who left his home and wanted to go to Yale. But instead of taking the SATs and applying for admission, he simply got on a bus, came to New Haven, walked in the classroom and started taking courses. He even turned in papers to teachers who did not know he was a student and began to receive grades. And so the story really began to follow what happened to him at Yale.
Reginald, did your brother's interest in movies, your older brother's interest in movies, help create your interest in films, in making films?
Sure. I think, seeing his films, seeing the films of other independent filmmakers, let me know that it was possible as a goal, because if he could do it, I knew I could do it. And it also let me know that there was a way of making movies other than the Hollywood way, that there was a way that you could actually take the budget limitations of independent movies and turn them into virtues. So that was very inspirational.
Your thesis at Harvard back in 1983 was a film. It was like an early version of House Party. How did that compare to the final film?
Well, the final film was longer. the short version was 20 minutes long. It actually had essentially the same plot. You know, it starts with the father telling him he can't go to the party. Then he sneaks out. He arrives at the party, hangs out with his friend, meets these two girls. You know, wants to sleep with one, but eventually doesn't. His friend chides him for not taking advantage. And what's the big deal about, you know, birth control? And then he sneaks home and gets his butt beat. So the basic genetic imprint of House Party was there in the short version. And as basically in the feature, I put in all the jokes that I couldn't afford or didn't have locations for, and so on.
Had the music and the dances and the language changed a lot by the time you made the 1990 House Party?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, thing about teen culture is that, I mean, I was starting to feel old when I was doing the first version in college, because I was talking to the high school kids who were actually in the film who, you know, were like, oh, no, that's not how you say it. You say it like this. So by the time we did the 1990 version, I was, you know, practically, you know, Bob Hope or somebody.
So
I knew I had to do that one first, because if I waited any longer, I would be hopelessly out of it.
And how did you find Kid in Play, who starred in House Party?
Well, we were watching BET one evening, and they were doing a parody of this TV commercial. It's a late-night TV commercial that sells this anthology of old 1970s love ballads. And it caused our attention because I directed that TV commercial, and it was kind of, you know, saying, hey, what are you making fun of? But we saw them at a party and kidded them about them kidding us. And really felt really good about the guys, and checked on their backgrounds and found out they were very serious young men who actually had both gone to college and very very sharp and responsible and would be good people to have on your creative team.
What was that commercial like for our listeners who hadn't seen it?
It's called Hey Love, the classic sounds of sexy soul.
Probably, if I don't know when this runs, but, you know, just turn on your TV around, you know, 1:30 this morning.
And it's still on?
It's sure to still be on. You know, it's funny, you do these little independent films, and you go to film festivals in Europe, and you win these awards and stuff. But there was no doubt, up until we did the feature version of House Party, that our Hey Love commercial was the most famous thing we had ever done.
The auteurs of the Hey Love commercial.
Exactly.
Hey, but you know,
the idea of going to, like, you know, Sammy's Chitlin Shop. But it's the Hey Love commercial.
But you know that that commercial got quoted in the film Say Anything.
Yeah, by Cameron Crowe. He's a funny guy.
So in Boomerang, everybody's dressed in really high fashion. I mean, they all work in the fashion industry in a way. I mean, they do commercials. So a lot of money, I think, was spent on hiring designers to come up with really cool-looking stuff. Do you both dress in high fashion or not?
You know, I was really hoping by doing the movie that I could come in after midnight and get some of those clothes. But they were under lock and key, so no, I'm left with my pre-Boomerang wardrobe, which does not compete.
Yeah, you know... I know one time I was talking with Eddie, and we were trying to decide what top he should wear. He said, look at you. Why are you telling me what I should wear? So I said, well, let's just call it, ask the costume designer, see what she thinks. She agreed with Eddie, so that was the end of my fashion consultant career.
Right, right.
But no, we're not high fashion guys.
There's one line in Boomerang that I have to ask you about. This is a line between David Allen
Greer. I'm sorry I shot you.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you were robbing my store.
Right. Why don't you explain the scene? You're going to do it better than I am.
Well, Halle Berry and David Allen Greer got on their first date, and it was started off very awkwardly, but it ended very well, and they're saying goodbye to one another. And David is so enraptured by her, but he doesn't want to go, so he keeps sort of popping his head back in the door saying goodbye in different languages. So it's like, goodbye, you know.
Adios.
Arrivederci, you know. And so finally she comes back I mean, totally unexpected, you know.
And says, in bad translation, sorry I shot you, but I thought you were robbing my store, which is...
She says that in Korean.
Well...
Yes, and so the idea is, it's, again, a throwaway social commentary on the tragedy that happened here in Los Angeles. And after the fact, I realized that it's been misinterpreted to be...
racist.
Yes. And that's not the intention. It was about that case, not about the Korean-American community.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that at the time, the girl, Latasha Hawkins, I believe was her name.
Harlins,
excuse me, had, you know, just gotten shot. And I mean,
killed.
Killed. And it was, the black community was furious, of course, because there was at the same time, was a black man who had gotten more time for killing a dog than the person who killed this young girl. And it was a tremendous amount of frustration. You know, it was a political joke.
So you meant this to be a comment on that one case? And
precisely.
Because that was exactly what was on everyone's mind at the time.
Let me tell you what happened when I saw it in the movie theater. Mm-hmm. You know, after David Alan Grier says goodbye in like four different languages, mm-hmm. and then Halle Berry starts to speak in, you know, what sounds like Korean. As soon as she starts speaking in Korean, the whole audience broke up laughing, and no one even heard that line when in the translation.
So,
I'm sorry.
Then how did
I
you get the line?
I read it in the newspaper. I read it in the newspaper.
Oh, the press again.
Yeah, I read it in the newspaper before I saw the movie, and I couldn't even hear it because people had already been laughing too hard. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really...
Well, we're not responsible for the review, the audiences.
The audience behavior.
The thing that's fascinating about this, lines that we thought were really, really funny. People laugh so-so. Other lines that we thought were like... okay to us, people crack up at. It's a really a learning experience making a comedy to find out what pushes people's funny button.
Well, I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us.
It's been our pleasure.
Reginald and Warrington Hudlin directed and produced Boomerang, starring Eddie Murphy. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the soon-to-be-official Democratic ticket?
They had a news conference today, Terry, and Mara Liasson was there in Little Rock, and we'll have a report. We're also going to convene a little discussion here about this ticket of two young white men from the same part of the country and see who's left out and how much that matters. We'll also be looking at some very troublesome things going on around the world. We'll be in touch with the Benich family, who live in a suburb of Sarajevo, where they're under siege. In fact, one member of the family was injured, shot, just standing in their own kitchen. We'll also be talking to UN officials in Somalia about the desperate situation of people there.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Prelude to a Kiss was a hit on and off Broadway a couple of years ago, but many people didn't get to see its star, Alec Baldwin. He only stuck around for the first 6 weeks of its run. Now he's back in the movie version, with Meg Ryan playing the role created by Mary Louise Parker. The movie was written by Craig Lucas and directed by Norman Renee, the same team that wrote and directed the play. They also collaborated on the film Longtime Companion. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Prelude to a Kiss.
The premise of Prelude to a Kiss is a terrific contraption, designed to let us all explore the meaning of life and love together and have fun along the way. Here's how it works. You start with a fabulous young couple. They meet at a party. They dance. They see that they're both smart and sexy, and both half-formed, both brimming on the edge of a wonderful life. Rita, played by cutesy Meg Ryan, is a bartender. Peter, played by hunky Alec Baldwin, works in scientific publishing. When he can't get her out of his mind, he shows up at the bar where she works and begins to tell her the story of his life.
Okay, this is the story, and I'm not making it up.
Okay.
And it's not as sad as it sounds.
Shoot.
My parents separated when I was four. I went to live with my grandparents, who are unfortunately deceased now. I'm gonna make this as brief as possible.
Take your time.
And?
We can go up to my place when you're done.
And everything worked out great for everybody. It was amazing.
It's all like that, the conversation in this movie, snappy and quippy and surfacey and banal. Nevertheless, these two wacky, wonderful kids are nuts for each other, and they decide to get married. But at the wedding, a strange thing happens. A distracted-looking old man named Julius, played by the stage actor Sidney Walker, wanders into the reception and asks to kiss the bride. When he does, the sun dims, the camera tilts, and before we know it, the spirit of old Julius has entered young Rita's body, while the inner Rita now resides within the outer Julius. So, will Peter realize that sexy little Rita is no longer Rita? And if he does, can he really be in love with a crusty old man, since the girl he adores now inhabits that crust? Those are fascinating questions, but once they're posed, the movie doesn't know what to do with them. And in the end, we don't either. For instance, we're told and told about Rita's insomnia and her fear of life. When Peter's new wife loses these traits, he knows Rita is no longer Rita. Unfortunately, though, those traits never made any sense in the first place. The Rita Meg Ryan plays is so spunky and adventurous and comfortable that her very screen presence makes us doubt everything we're being told about her. Meanwhile, Sidney Walker, the strangely hypnotic actor who plays Julius, takes everything too slowly. And that makes Lucas's messagey dialogue sound even more tedious than it needed to. Besides which, it's almost impossible to detect lively Rita inside this sluggish old plotter. And there's one more thing. Storytelling is always a kind of shorthand. It's a shorthand for life. The chaos of things that happen to us every day are distilled into incidents. And the complex, that is, every human being, is distilled into character traits. The problem with Prelude to a Kiss is that writer Craig Lucas has made the kind of mistake only a storyteller would make. He's mistaken a theatrical device, character traits, for character itself, the thing they represent. And since we all know, however unconsciously, that people are far more complex and changeable and unpredictable than any series of character traits, we may, without quite knowing why, find that nothing in Prelude to a Kiss convinces us. We all know, for instance, insomniacs who learn to sleep, or sleepers who become insomniacs. The trait is not the person. Maybe Craig Lucas and the director Norman Rene should get out more, away from the life of the theater. The questions they're asking here are the real thing, but the answers are, well, play things.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Ojiva Blytus and Thad Kirk. Our program was directed this week by Sue Spolin. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the tuberculosis epidemic. To find out why a disease we thought we had controlled is on the rise again, and to find out who is most at risk, we'll talk to Dr. Barry Bloom, the former chair of the World Health Organization's TB Committee. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.